could happen in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. It could happen in a moment, he could break the eastern sky.
Though our hearts will feel unworthy, yet how happy we will be.
Savior comes from heaven, when his blessed face we see.
I am listening every moment,
listening every moment,
for the mighty trumpet sound.
Mighty trumpet sound.
What a time we'll have
together. Time we'll have together.
When the saints shall leave the ground.
Saints shall leave the ground.
All our toiling will be sorrow and its pain.
It could happen in a moment. Jesus Christ could come again.
It could
happen in a moment, any minute of the day. He could call us home to heaven, there forever to stay.
Hold the fort a little longer, ooh, in your struggle over sin.
Trust the great commander's promise, he will surely come again.
I am listening every
listening
moment,
listening every moment,
for the mighty trumpet
sound. In a moment, Jesus Christ could come again.
Success or failure in many areas of life depends upon whether we are prepared. To prepare means to make ready. This is especially true in spiritual things. The prophet Amos commands in Amos 4 and 12, "Prepare to meet thy God, O Israel." This is a very necessary duty for us today. Make ready to meet thy God. There is coming a time in which we will have to meet God, the great judgment day. We will have to give an account for all our deeds. Those sins which are not forgiven will be held against us. What an awesome occasion this will be. The only answer is for us to prepare. Make ready to meet God. We must become acquainted with the Word of God to be able to meet God. One of the reasons for our study is to help us to prepare to meet God. Each of these lessons is available free on cassette tape. For your free copy of any of these lessons presented on this program, please contact me, Dr. N.C. Crouch, Hamilton, Texas.
There are many things I've done for which I'm now ashamed. There were times I did not hold up Jesus' precious name. May I live for him and let him take away all blame.
Given time,
given time,
given time,
given time,
given time.
Dear Father, I will do my very best.
With your hand
to guide me, I can overcome each test.
There are
many things I'd like to do before I rest.
Given time,
given time,
given time,
given time. There are many words I've said that hurt the ones I love. I've not always offered prayers to him who lives above. May my lips say sweeter things that please the holy dove.
Given time,
given time,
given time.
We're continuing our study in the fourth chapter of Acts. Peter and John have just heal the lame man in the temple by the miraculous power of God. They have been preaching the gospel to the multitude that were assembled as a result of that miraculous deed, and they were arrested by the Jewish authorities, taken before the Sanhedrin council, and charged not to teach anymore in this man's name. They were strictly commanded not to do it anymore by the law of the land. So the apostles said to the council, "Whether it be right in the sight of God to hearken unto you more than unto God, judge ye. For we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard." So the council charged them that they should not teach in this man's name, and they let the apostles go. Well, the apostles went back to the rest of the church, and when the church heard this, then they assembled together for a prayer. We're in the midst of that prayer. They began the prayer in verse 24 by saying, "Lord, thou art God, which hast made heaven and earth and the sea and all that in them is." This is a quotation of Psalms 146, verse 6, and they're simply establishing the fact that they do have a firm belief in the fact that God is the sovereign power. His authority overrules any other authority here upon this earth, so when the law of the land tells them they can't preach the gospel, they appeal to the authority of God then as being the rule by which they're going to follow, regardless of what the law of men may say. This would only be applicable in cases in which the law of the land conflicted with the law of God. It's a rare thing for it to happen, but it does happen sometimes, and it did happen here to these apostles. So we're continuing now in the 25th verse with this prayer that they're giving to God, and they are describing now the qualities of God and the law and the plan of God. Verse 25, they say, "Who by the mouth of thy servant David has said." Now they're going to quote from the second psalm, the first two verses of the second psalm, and they truly do believe that this psalm was written by David because they ascribe it to the servant David. And as they quote from this second psalm, they are giving forth now with some of the prophecies about this age, prophecies about the church, and they're beginning to understand how these prophecies are being fulfilled. Here, these apostles had gone out to preach the gospel, to teach the facts about this new kingdom, about this church, and they see that they've met with tremendous opposition. They've been arrested. They've been threatened. They could have even been put to death, and they may yet be put to death. And so they're beginning to put this all together now as to what the prophets have said about this time. So this second psalm, verse 1 and 2, is quoted. "By the mouth of thy servant David has said, why did the heathen rage and the people imagine vain things?" This word here for heathen actually refers to the nations which were not Jews. It refers to the opposition which would be made to the spread of Christianity, not merely to the opposition made to the Messiah himself and to the act of putting him to death, but the general opposition that the world would have to the spread of the gospel. Why did the heathen rage? This refers to the excitement and the tumult of a multitude, not a settled plan, but rather the heated and disorderly conduct of a mob. It means that the progress of the gospel would encounter tumultuous opposition, and that the excited nations would rush violently to put it down and to destroy it. So why did the heathen rage and the people imagine vain things? The word here for people means essentially the same as heathen. It means the people in general. Imagine vain things. The word imagine means to meditate or to think or to purpose. So in their minds, they were imagining things that are called vain things. That is, things that are empty or useless, that do not amount to anything, that are really not the truth. So the minds of the people are going to be turned against the spread of this gospel. They're going to imagine vain things, empty things, untrue things about it. And that was prophesied way back there by David. So it seems to be a very appropriate thing for them to quote now as they begin to see what great opposition they truly are going to have. How that they are really going to be up against it now in spreading this gospel. They've got a lot of obstacles to overcome, but they simply are relating it to a fulfillment. This is the fulfillment of what was said way back there by David about this very time. They further quote from this psalm in the next verse, verse 26. "The kings of the earth stood up, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. Now this would refer not only to the future difficulties of the church, but it also is including the time whenever they were opposing the Messiah himself while here upon this earth, and whenever they actually put him to death. The kings of the earth stood up, and the rulers were gathered together. So all authorities, all powers are going to find themselves being in a position to be opposed to Christianity. They'll be gathered against the Lord and against his Christ. Now this was stated back in the second Psalm. The word there for Christ, which means Messiah, is translated as anointed, but it means the same thing. It can refer to a king, it can refer to Messiah, and here, of course, the word Christ means Messiah. So they are taking some consolation, but also they are aligning themselves in accordance to what this prophecy has said, and it gives them understanding now as they make an application of it like this. So this phrase, the kings of the earth stood up, means that they were standing opposed to this Messiah, this gospel, this plan. The rulers is still the same class of people as the kings. They were gathered together. That is, they had united together. Regardless of how they may be opposed to each other in other matters, when it comes to the matter of the spread of this gospel, when it comes to Christianity, they were united together against the Lord. That is against God and against his Christ or his Messiah. So we see that whatever efforts then were made against the church were against the Lord and against the Messiah. And then in verse 27, in the midst of this prayer, they give an interpretation of what David is saying in the second Psalm. It says in verse 27, "For of a truth, against thy holy child Jesus, whom thou hast anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate and the Gentiles and the people of Israel were gathered together." Now here is the conclusion of this matter. This truly did happen. This prophecy has been fulfilled to a certain extent. Doesn't mean that it was completely fulfilled and would never continue to happen, but it was fulfilled up to this point. Of a truth, this truly has happened. It was against the Holy Child Jesus, and the word child here doesn't necessarily mean a small child, but it can mean even a young man. It was against the Holy Child Jesus, the Son of God. It could more properly be translated as Son. It was against this Holy Son, whom thou hast anointed, who God did appoint, made him the Messiah, put him in this position of having ruling authority. It was against him that both Herod and Pontius Pilate, Herod would be the ruler of the Jews, Pontius Pilate would be the ruler of the Gentiles. With the Gentiles, here are the Gentiles in general, the Roman soldiers, and the people of Israel, here are the people of Israel in general, were gathered together. So all of these groups of people, the Jews, the Gentiles, the ruler of the Jews, the ruler of the Gentiles, were gathered together. That is, they had a common purpose, united against the Messiah. Now they may have other things that they differ greatly on among themselves, but they then united together against the Lord and his anointed in this particular case. They were gathered together. Verse 28 says, "For to do whatsoever thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done." They were simply fulfilling this prophecy that was given in the second Psalm. God had already determined this would be done. He'd already predicted that it would be done. And so the apostles are getting a great perspective here now. They're beginning to see just how this thing is falling. They're beginning to see where they stand in the midst of this great event that the second Psalm prophesied would happen. And so when you can stop and get a perspective about the problem, and when you can see where you are in the midst of this great fulfillment of things, it gives you the ability to see just what is going on, and you're not blinded, you're not in the dark and groping around and wondering what's happening, but you can see what's happening. And so this is why it's well for us to be able to understand these prophecies and to see how they are to be applied and to see just what our role is in the application of these prophecies. We see that simply God's plan is being carried out. So instead of them being frustrated, instead of them feeling like, well, maybe this is a lost cause, maybe there is no use, maybe we ought to just give this thing up, it would give them strength and encouragement to see that this was simply going according to the way God said it would go. Now, we do not have enough time to examine all the causes of this opposition, but there has always been a great opposition to the gospel. There's always been many obstacles in the path of the church. And so we might just note here some of the reasons why that this great opposition was then and why it is still today. First of all, the Jewish rulers were mortified. They were humbled and moved with envy that one so poor and so despised should claim to be the Messiah. They'd expected a Messiah of a different rank and character, and all the prejudices rose at once against his claims to this high office. The very fact that this carpenter's son born in Nazareth would rise up and be proclaimed to be the Messiah, it was just more than they could take. Then when we look at the common people, they were wanting to acknowledge his claims, but yet they were urged on by the enraged and vindictive priest to demand his death. And so they then were led in the wrong direction. They were led by the powers of the land, by the ones that had the most authority and influence, and they were turned then away from their original purpose to stand behind the Messiah. Well, Pilate, who was the ruler of the Jews, he was pressed on against his will by the enraged multitude to deliver Christ, whom he regarded as innocent, but he was pressed to deliver him to be crucified. Well, as the Christian religion advanced, we see that it struck at once at the whole fabric of superstition in the Roman Empire and throughout the world. It did not, like other religions, ask a place amidst the religions already existing. It didn't want to be just named among the other religions, but it was exclusive in its claims. It denounced all other systems as idolatry or superstition and sought to overthrow them. So those religions were interwoven with all the habits of the people. They were connected with all the departments of the state. They gave occupation to a vast number of priests and other officers who obtained their livelihood by the existing superstitions and who brought, of course, all the supposed sacredness of their character to support them. So this was a religion which attempted to overthrow the whole fabric of what now existed. Therefore, it was one that at once excited all their malice. The monarchs whose thrones were based on the existing state of things, and the people who venerated and worshipped the religion of their ancestors would be opposed to the new system. And so we see that since Christianity has to be opposed to all things that are false, all things that are not truth, it immediately has a lot of built-in opposition to it wherever it may go. It is changing the existing order of things because it is changing the ideas, the thoughts, the habits, the practices of the people and the rulers. So Christianity was despised. It was regarded as one form of superstition of the Jews, and there were no people who regarded it with so much contempt by the other nations as the Jews were. The writings of the Romans on this point are full proof. The new religion was opposed to all the crimes of the world. It began its career in a time of imminent wickedness. It plunged at once into the midst of that wickedness and sought the great cities where crimes and pollution were concentrated and tried to reprove every form of prevalent unholiness. At Athens, at Corinth, at Ephesus, at Rome itself, it denounced the judgment of God against every form of guilt. Whatever may be charged on the apostles, it will not be alleged that they were timid in denouncing the sins of the world. So as we look at all of these various causes at why the church may be persecuted, it is no wonder that the early Christians were persecuted. And it may be asked why the same religion meets with opposition now in lands that are stated in name to be Christian, while we can see that we're going to still have great opposition to the true church. The true church will not occupy the same realm as the false church, as those pretenders, as those that are practicing Christianity in a way that's not according to the truth. Those who claim to be Christians but who are not true Christians are going to oppose the true church now just as much as it's ever been opposed in the past. And so if we ask why is this opposition still existent, Well, we can answer it by saying that the human heart is the same that it's always been, opposed to truth and righteousness, that religion encounters still a host of sins that are opposed to it, pride, envy, malice, passion, and the love of the world, that there's always been a peculiar opposition in the human heart to receiving salvation as the gift of God through a crucified Redeemer, and that all the forms of vice and lust and profaneness that exist in the world are opposed and ever will be opposed to a religion of purity, self-denial, and love. But we'd like to also note that the fact that Christianity has been opposed like it has, and the fact that it has triumphed over all of this great opposition, is great proof of its divine origin. It has been fairly tried, and it still survived. It was well to put it to the test and to bring to bear on it everything that had a tendency to crush it, and thus to furnish the highest proof that it is from God. Were it from some other source, it would not have been able to survive all of this great opposition. This religion cannot be destroyed. It will triumph. Opposition to it is vain. It will make its way throughout all the world. And the path of safety is not the path to oppose that which God is intending to establish in the earth. Sinners who stand opposed to the gospel should tremble and be afraid, for sooner or later they must fall before its triumphant advances. It is not safe to oppose that which has already been opposed by the kings and rulers in every form, and yet it has come out victorious. It's not wise to risk one's eternal welfare, to risk the salvation of the soul, on the question of successful opposition to that which God has, in so many ages and ways, pledged himself to protect. And when God has solemnly declared that the Son, the Messiah, whom he would set on his holy hill of Zion, should break his enemies with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel in Psalm 2, verse 9. So if you find yourself standing in any way opposed to the true church, the doctrines of the true church, you've got something that's just near to it but not quite the same, you're in a very dangerous path. You're opposing that God has established. You're opposing that no ruler, no power in the past has been able to overcome. It has overcome, it has triumphed, and it will continue to triumph. So friend, be careful which course you tread, which path you take. Do not take the way that's going to be in opposition to the truth. Any form of truth must not be opposed. Otherwise, you're walking on a very dangerous path. Do not allow the apostate church or any other form of false doctrine to infiltrate your mind and your thinking to the point that you're going to be in opposition to the true church that was established by God. And so after stating that this opposition that they were receiving as they taught the gospel, this opposition was coming from the authorities of the land, and that it was according to the prophecies of God that God had foredetermined that the heathen would rage and the people would imagine a vain thing and that the princes and all would be against them. They can begin to conclude this prayer in verse 29 by saying, "And now, Lord, behold their threatenings." We'd just like, God, for you to take note of the fact that we are under this duress, that we're under this great amount of stress placed upon us by the authorities. Behold their threatenings. Do not forget about us, Lord. Continue to observe what our problem is. Behold their threatenings, and grant unto thy servants that with all boldness they may speak the word. Now, they didn't ask that the servants be delivered from any problems or persecutions. They didn't ask that the servants have no more threatenings given to them, or that the servants be able to be relieved of any kind of discomfort. They asked that God would, with all boldness, grant that their servants may speak thy word. Give us the power. Give us the strength. Give us the courage to do the things that we need to do. And we see that this attitude that they have here is an example of heroic boldness. It is a determination to persevere in doing their duty to God. And so when we are assailed by those in power, when we're persecuted and in danger, we should commit our way unto God and seek his aid that we may not be deterred from the path of duty. Verse 30 says, "By stretching forth thine hand to heal." Now this is a continuation of the previous sentence. "That we may with all boldness speak thy word, by stretching forth thy hand to heal." That is, God would continue to do his powers. He would continue to let them have this ability to heal those that were in need of healing so that they could demonstrate that they were from God. And he further says, and that signs and wonders may be done by the name of thy holy child Jesus. So they wanted God to continue to perform his miracles, to continue to give them this power to demonstrate that they were truly the followers of God, that they were the messengers of God, so that this message of the Messiah, this truth of the gospel, could be spread, could be taught, and would be received by those who heard it. This phrase, signs and wonders, simply means the miracles that God would perform and had performed up to this time at their hand. And it was done in the name of thy holy child Jesus, that is done by the authority of the Messiah, of Jesus Christ. And we see that the primary miracle that's mentioned here is that one of healing. Healing is the one in which they would relieve others of suffering and disease, but the primary purpose of the miracle wasn't to heal the person, but it was to show that the one who was able to perform the miracle was from God, so that the message would be a credible message, so that the message would be believed. Because up to this point, many of the things that they taught were new doctrine and were not confirmed by writings that we now know as scriptures. Today we do not need to be able to perform these miracles to prove that we're from God, because we can have our message referred to in the Holy Scriptures to verify whether or not they're true. We're going to close at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.
A gentle calm,
sweet calm, is the peace that comes from heaven above.
A lovely song,
sweet song, sweeping o'er my soul, is God's great love.
To me it's
dearer than gold,
it's what can
never be told. What joy, this great joy,
there's perfect
joy in serving him,
for
he set me free, makes the heart to sing.
Thy glory
in the Savior's cross, gladly suffer loss, he's my everything.
Each day I trust
and I lean upon his promise true.
I have no
fear and no dread,
I know that
waiting ahead is joy, God's great joy.
I'm happy now,
right now, in the Lord, no matter what betides.
And I have joy,
for I know the Lord with me abides.
No matter
what some may say,
they cannot
take it away. What joy, this great joy,
there's perfect
joy in serving him,
for
he set me free, makes the heart to sing. In the Savior's cross, gladly suffer loss, he's my everything. Each day I trust.
Greater riches will be mine, but until then, I will feast on God's blessings today. I have eyes that I can see, ears to hear the gentle breeze, and a voice to sing his praises always.
All the words to express all the beauty God has spoken into me.
is going to flourish, it's going to do well.